理课堂听 class.com。
Part 3, Chapter 1, Section 2, Exercise.
Passage 1. Another secret of the animals is embodied in a basic law of nature, which men often ignore. Every animal has around him a security zone. Within that zone, he feels safe.Simple observation shows what happens to creatures whose sense of adequate living spaces has been consistently violated, and who have thus become degenerate. You only have to go to a zoo. There you find animals sitting like prisoners, tucked so close together that it is not surprising they become frustrated and sometimes so tense that they try to break out.Then they have to be destroyed. When people see animals in this condition, they get the impression that the animals are either dangerous and aggressive or lazy and stupid. But animals that I have known in their natural state are never like this. This shows why zoos, even the best zoos, cannot solve the problem of recovering a healthy survival number of presently endangered species.The security zone sense, the need for adequate living space, is not limited to wild animals. Men once had it, too. But now our awareness of it has grown so faint that 4 or 5 people can live together in one room. People living in such conditions often become aggressive and sometimes even criminal for the same reason that animals do in zoos.
Questions 1 to 3 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 1.
Why do the animals in zoos seem frustrated?
Question 2.
Which of the following is true according to the passage?
Question 3.
What do we know about men's sense of adequate living space from the passage?
Passage 2. One of the most popular myths about the United States in the 19th century was that the free and simple life of the farmer. It was said that the farmers worked hard on their own land to produce whatever their families needed. They might sometimes trade with their neighbors, but in general they could get along well by relying on themselves, not on commercial ties to others. This is how Thomas Jefferson idealized the farmers.At the beginning of the 19th century, sweeping changes in agriculture were well underway as farmers began to specialize in the raising of crops, such as cotton and wheat. By late in the century, revolutionary advances in farm machinery had vastly increased production of specialized crops, and extensive networks of railroads had linked farmers throughout the century to markets in the East and even overseas.By raising and selling specialized crops, farmers could afford more and finer goods and achieved a much higher standard of living, but at a low price. Now farmers were no longer dependent just on weather and their own efforts. Their lives were increasingly controlled by banks, which had power to grant or deny loans for new machinery.And by the railroads which set the rates for shipping their crops to markets. As businessmen, farmers now had to worry about the national economic depression and the influences of the 19th century. The era of Jefferson's independent farmer had come to a close. Questions 4 to 6 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 4.
Which of the following does not fall into Thomas Jefferson's ideal of farmers?
Question 5.
Which of the following is increasingly controlling the farmers' lives?
Question 6.
What can we learn about today's farmers according to the passage? Passage 3. Now that I've extracted your tooth, I want to give you some words of advice. Remember that this is surgery. You need to go home and rest for the rest of the day. You shouldn't do your regular work. Since you're an adult, it might take you longer to heal than if you were a child. The numbness will wear off after a few hours, and if it's painful after that, you should take 2 aspirins. Now, the most important thing to remember is to apply ice to your cheek immediately when you get home. This will keep the swelling down. You can use an ice bag or put chopped ice in a towel. Hold it on your cheek over the extraction area for 20 minutes and then take it off for 20 minutes. Keep this for 4 or 5 hours. Secondly, don't rinse your mouth today. Tomorrow you should rinse your mouth gently every 3 or 4 hours with salt water. Put about 1/4 teaspoon of salt in a glass of warm water. Continue this rinsing for several days. Don't be alarmed if there is some bleeding this morning. A little bleeding is normal following an extraction. I've put absorbent cotton over the extraction and I will give you some to take home. Change the pads about 1/2 hour after you get home. That's all you need to do. Call me if you have a lot of bleeding or pain, and remember to apply ice right away.
Questions 7 to 9 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 7.
Which of the following statements is true according to the speaker?
Question 8.
What should a patient do immediately when he gets home after tooth extraction?
Question 9.
How should a patient deal with a little bleeding following tooth extraction?
Passage 4. Time and time again, one may be warned. Your name will be mud. Many have used the expression in the mistaken belief that it has something to do with the kind of dirt found in the street or an unclean river bottoms. But the expression comes from the name of Dr. Samuel Alexander Mudd, a physician who fixed the broken leg of John Wilkes Booth, the man who killed President Abraham Lincoln. Dr. Mudd treated Booth's injured leg without knowing who he was. A small group helped Booth to plan Lincoln's murder. They were all caught and sentenced to death or prison terms. Dr. Mudd had nothing to do with Lincoln's murder or with any of the men who had planned it. all seemed to show that he was an innocent man. But he had given some kind of help only to leave Booth to escape. This in itself was a crime then, and so Dr. Mudd was sentenced to prison for life. In prison, Dr. Mudd saved many prisoners and guards in the yellow fever outbreak. President Andrew Johnson pardoned him in 1869, after the doctor had spent almost 4 years in prison. The American people considered the murder of Lincoln a heavy blow to them. It filled them with bitterness and lasted many years. They hated Booth very much, and they also hated anybody who helped the murderer in any way. Dr. Mudd was freed, but people never forgave him, and his name passed into American folk speech as something bad, hateful. The Mudd family had also suffered a lot because of the name until not long ago. Questions 10 to 12 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 10.
What does the expression "your name will be Mudd" mean according to the passage?
Question 11.
Why was Mudd sentenced to life imprisonment?
Question 12.
But for President Andrew Johnson, which of the following is true about Mudd? Passage 5. Science fiction writers have often imagined human beings going to live on the Mars. But these days, scientists are taking the idea seriously. It has a great deal to recommend it, since it might solve the problem of overcrowding on the Earth. But obviously, it would not be worth making the effort unless people could live there naturally. If the atmosphere were like that of the Earth, this might be possible. But in fact, it is mostly carbon dioxide. Apart from that, there are other problems to be overcome. For example, the temperature would have to be raised from 60 degrees below zero to 15 degrees above it. Scientists who study Mars have laid down the program that they can follow. To begin with, they will have to find out whether life has ever existed on the planet of Mars in the past. Secondly, they will have to make a reliable map of its surface. And finally, they will have to make a list of the gases. Above all, they will have to discover how much nitrogen it possesses, since nitrogen is 4/5 of the air we breathe. They are surprisingly optimistic about raising the temperature on Mars and believe it could be done in 200 years. It will take a bit longer, though, to transform the atmosphere so that human beings could live there. Scientists estimate that this will take 100,000 years.
Questions 13 to 16 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 13.
Why are scientists interested in Mars?
Question 14.
What is one of the things that must be done before man can live on Mars?
Question 15.
Why do scientists want to find out whether there is sufficient nitrogen on Mars?
Question 16.
What is the prospect of people living on Mars?
Passage 6. Let's turn our focus now to advertising. We all know what an advertisement is. It's essentially a message that announces something for sale. Now there is an important precondition that must exist before you have advertising. And that's a large supply of consumer goods. That is, things to sell. You see, in a place where the demand for a product is greater than the supply, there's no need to advertise. Now, the earliest form of advertising, going back many hundreds of years, was a simple sign. There were shop doors that told you whether the shop was a bakery, a butcher shop, or what have you. Then was the advent of the printing press. Advertising increased substantially as ads for products like coffee, tea and chocolate appeared in newspapers and other periodicals, as well as on the side of the buildings. By modern standards, these early advertisements were quite small and subdued. Not the splashy whole-page spreads of today. Still, some of them appeared on the front pages of newspapers. Probably because the news often consisted of less than fresh reports from distant Europe, while the ads were current or local. During the Industrial Revolution, suddenly there was a much greater supply of things to sell. And as we said earlier, that is the driving force behind advertising. People's attention has to be drawn to the new product. Questions 17 to 19 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 17.
What is the main topic of the talk?
Question 18.
What does the speaker say is the important precondition for advertising?
Question 19.
According to the speaker, what were the first advertisements? Passage 7. We all scream for water when thirsty, but do you know, in very hot, dry weather, plants also make faint sounds, as if they are crying out for help? You see, in a plant's stem there are hundreds of water pipes that bring water and minerals from the soil all the way up to the leaves. As the ground turns dry, it becomes harder and harder for the plants to do this. In severe droughts, plants have to fight to pull out any water available. Scientist Robert Winter has found out that when it is really bad, their water pipes snap from the tension like rubber bands. When that happens, the whole plant vibrates a little. The snapping pipes make noises 10,000 times more quiet than a whisper. Robert knows that healthy, well-watered plants are quiet. He also knows that many insects prefer attacking dry plants rather than healthy plants. How do the insects know which are healthy plants and which are not? Robert thinks that the insects may listen for the plants that cry and then they may buzz in to kill. To test his theory, Robert is using a device that can imitate plant cries. He attaches it to a quiet, healthy plant, so the plant sounds thirsty. Then he watches insects to see if they attack more often than usual. If he is right, scientists could use the insects' ability against them. They could build traps that imitate crying plants. So, when the insects buzz in to eat, they won't buzz out.
Questions 20 to 22 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 20.
What do plants do when they are thirsty?
Question 21.
What plants do many insects tend to attack? What could scientists do if Robert's theory proves to be true?
Passage 8. If the Earth gets hotter in the new century, what will happen to animals and the plants which animals depend on for survival? The question offers another way of looking at the greenhouse effect. People have talked about the general problem of global warming for some time, but they were usually worried about things like whether to buy a home on the coast. Biologists and other scientists turned their attention to plants and animals at an important meeting that took place last October. They reviewed evidence that plants and animals were sensitive to climate. Since the Ice Age ended 10,000 years ago, the warmer temperatures returned to the northern latitude. Many species have migrated north. If the predictions about the greenhouse are correct, temperatures will rise by the same amount in the next 100 years as they did in the past 10,000. Will animals and plants be able to adapt that quickly to change in the environment? Many won't. Certain species will probably become very rare. Experts say plants under climate stress will be very open to disease and fire. Forest fires may become more common. That in turn may harm animals that depend on the trees for food and shelter. Any preserves we set up to protect the endangered species may become useless as the species are forced to migrate along with their natural homes. Changes are part of life, but rapid changes, says scientist George Woodwill, is the enemy of life. Questions 23 to 26 are based on the passage that you have just heard. Question 23.
What is the concern of ordinary people about the greenhouse effect? What has happened since the end of Ice Age? What will be a possible threat to plants in the future? According to the passage, what will probably happen to the endangered species?
Passage 9.
Everybody has to die someday, but nobody likes to think about it. Even so, at some time in their lives, most people manage to think about the question of how to make a will. If you have already made yours, it is probably just a few pages of writing stating that you wish to leave everything to your family. That's the kind of will that the majority of people make. However, there are plenty of ways to make your will more interesting if you want to. To begin with, you don't have to write it on paper. One man wrote his will on an envelope, another on the door, and a third on an egg. For some people, the most important part of their will is the part that says how they want to be buried. Mrs. Sandra West, a rich widow from Texas, decided that she wanted to be buried with her favorite car. In 1973, Mr. Green, a dentist from England, left most of his money to the nurse who worked for him if in 5 years she wouldn't wear any kind of makeup or jewelry or go out with men. Finally, let's hope that your will is not like that of Dr. Wagner, who lived in America 100 years ago. His family, who had not been to see him for years, suddenly began to visit him when he became ill. What was worse, each person suggested to Dr. Wagner that they would like something to remember him by when he died. Greatly annoyed with them, Dr. Wagner wrote a will that would do this. To each of his 4 brothers, he left one of his legs or arms. His nephew got his nose, and his 2 nieces each got an ear. His teeth went to his cousins. Then he set aside $1,000 to pay for cutting up his body, and the rest of his money he left to the poor.
Questions 27 to 29 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 27.
What kind of will do most people leave behind, according to the passage?
Question 28.
What did the nurse have to do before getting the money left by the English dentist?
Question 29.
Why did Dr. Wagner make an unusual will?
Passage 10. The worldwide organisation of the Red Cross stems from the idea of Henry Dunant, a Swiss banker. In 1838, at the age of 10, Dunant was taken by his father to visit a prison. There he saw prisoners chained together exercising in the yard and breaking stones along the road. This experience left a deep impression on him and made him determined to do something for convicts and slaves, and for all those who were oppressed and deprived of their liberty. On the 24th of June 1859, while he was away from Geneva to France, Dunant witnessed a battle between the French and the Austrian armies. It was one of the fiercest battles of the 19th century. Shocked by the lack of medical supplies and the attention given to the wounded, Dunant decided volunteer service had to be organised. He gathered together a number of women who attended hundreds of wounded soldiers of all nationalities and helped the surgeons as best as they could. From the battle, Dunant determined to form a body of people who would rally together in times of war and attend to the needs of wounded and dying. Dunant held that suffering human being should be helped for his own sake, only without regard to race, religion, or political belief. Many European states supported him, and on 22nd of August 1864, the first Geneva Convention was signed. This lays down that once the soldier is wounded, he and everyone who comes to his help cease to be an enemy. A symbol by which a relief worker could be recognized was devised. As a tribute to Switzerland, the symbol was a Swiss flag, reversed. That is, a red cross on a white background. So the Red Cross was born. Questions 30 to 33 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 30.
What first led Henri Dunant to think of helping the oppressed?
Question 31.
What did Henri Dunant do during the battle between the French and Austrian armies?
Question 32.
What was Henri Dunant's belief when he founded the Red Cross?
Question 33.
Why was the symbol of the Red Cross designed with a red cross on white ground?
Part 3, Chapter 1, Section 3. Exercise.
Passage 1. Living at the foot of one of the world's most active volcanoes might not appeal to you at all, but believe it or not, the area surrounding Mount Etna in Italy is packed with people. In fact, it is the most densely populated region on the whole island of Sicily. The reason is that the rich volcanic soil makes the land fantastic for farming. By growing and selling a variety of crops, local people earn a good living. For them, the economic benefit they reap surpasses the risk of dying or losing property in one of the volcano's frequent eruptions. People everywhere make decisions about risky situations this way, that is, by comparing the risks and the benefits. According to the experts, the size of the risk depends on both its probability and seriousness. Let's take Mount Etna, for example. It does erupt frequently, but those eruptions are usually minor, so the overall risk for people living nearby is relatively small. But suppose Mount Etna erupted every day, or imagine that each eruption there kills thousands of people. If that were the case, the risk would be much larger. Indeed, the risk would be too large for many people to live with, and they would have to move away.
Questions 1 to 3 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 1.
How do people make decisions about risky situations?
Question 2.
What do we know about Mount Etna from the passage?
Question 3.
What will people living near Mount Etna do in the face of its eruptions?
Passage 2. American visitors to East Asia are often surprised and puzzled by how Asian cultures and customs differ from those in the United States. What's considered typical or proper social conduct in one country may be regarded as odd, improper, or even rude in another. For example, people from some East Asian countries may begin a conversation with a stranger by asking personal questions about family, home, or work. Such questions are thought to be friendly, whereas they might be considered offensive in the United States. On the other hand, people in most Asian cultures are far more guarded about expressing their feelings publicly than most Americans are. Openly displaying annoyance or anger, yelling, arguing loudly, and so forth is considered ill-mannered in countries such as Japan. Many East Asians prefer to hold their emotions in check and instead express themselves with great politeness. They try not to be blunt and avoid making direct criticisms. In fact, they often keep their differences of opinion to themselves and merely smile and remain silent rather than engaging in a confrontation. By comparison, Americans are often frank about displaying both positive and negative emotions on the street and in other public places. Americans visiting Asia should keep in mind that such behavior may cause offense. A major difference between American culture and most East Asian culture is that in East Asia, the community is more important than the individual. Most Americans are considered a success when they make a name for themselves. Questions 4 to 6 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 4.
How would some Asians start their conversation when they meet for the first time?
Question 5.
What would a Japanese do when he feels annoyed?
Question 6.
What is encouraged in American culture according to the passage?
Passage 3.
After the early period of settlement, the first sharp increase in immigration took place in the 1830s and 1840s. This brought to America craftspeople from Northern Europe, who lost employment in the Industrial Revolution, then a great number of Irish people who fled from famine. German political refugees arrived shortly after. Many immigrants from Northern and Western Europe settled down on farms in the Middle West. The Irish became construction laborers on roads, bridges, and railroads. In the 1880s, a tremendous tide of immigrants began to come in, this time largely from Southern and Eastern Europe. To most Americans, these newcomers seemed far more stranger than the earlier settlers. Their languages, customs, and ways of life were very different from those of Americans. The newcomers moved into the poorest neighborhoods of the large cities. They tended to stay together and cling to their old ways. As they were accustomed to poverty, they were willing to work for very low wages. This made other workers, especially those in labor unions, afraid that the immigrants would thus lower wage levels and take jobs away from them. Indeed, organized labor became one of the chief opponents of continued immigration. This opposition finally led to the passing of the immigration laws in the 1920s, which restricted further immigration. In 1965, these unfair laws were replaced by a new Immigration Act, which granted equal opportunities to foreigners, regardless of their place of origin. Asians, like Koreans and Vietnamese, then began to arrive. Many of these newcomers have worked very hard to establish themselves in their new land.
Questions 7 to 10 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 7.
Why did Northern European craftspeople come to settle down in the United States?
Question 8.
What did the labour unions worry about?
Question 9.
What was the purpose of the immigration law passed in the 1920s?
Question 10.
What do we know from the passage about the Asian immigrants?
Passage 4. A few months ago, millions of people in London heard alarms all over the town. Emergency services at the fire department, the police, hospitals and ambulances stood by, ready to go into action. The railway and underground stations, people read notices and maps, which told them where to go and what to do in the emergency. This was Exercise Flood Call, to prepare people for a flood emergency. London wasn't flooded yet, but it is possible that it would be. In 1236 and in 1663, London was badly flooded. In 1928, people living in Westminster, the heart of London, drowned in floods. And in 1953, 100 people living on the eastern edge of the London suburbs were killed again in the floods. At last, Greater London Council took action to prevent this disaster from happening again. Though a flood wall was built in the 1980s, Londoners still must be prepared for the possible disaster. If it happens, 50 underground stations will be underwater. Electricity, gas and phone services will be out of action. Roads will be drowned. It will be impossible to cross any of the bridges between North and South London. Imagine! London will look like the famous Italian city Venice. But this Exercise Flood Call didn't cause panic amongst Londoners. Most people knew it was just a warning. One lady said, "It's a flood warning, isn't it? The water doesn't look high to me." Questions 11 to 13 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 11.
What happened in London a few months ago?
Question 12.
What measure was taken against floods in London in the 1980s?
Question 13.
What can we learn from the lady's comment?
Passage 5.
There are some serious problems in the Biramichi River. The local Chamber of Commerce, which represents the industries in the area, hired me as a consultant to do a one-year study on fishing in the Biramichi River and write a report for them. This is my report. One of the major problems in the Biramichi River is that the level of oxygen in the water is too low. Several chemicals have displaced the oxygen. This chemical pollution has two sources: the factories which dump polluted water directly into the river, and the local community which dumps untreated human wastes into the river. The local town government has already spent $2 million on wastewater treatment projects, but it would cost another $27 million to complete the projects. It would take at least 15 years for the town to collect enough revenue from taxes to complete these projects. The factories here employ 17,000 people in an area where there is very little alternative employment. It is not economically practical to close or relocate these factories. Also, the factories cannot afford to finance chemical treatment plants by themselves. Another problem is that the members of the Biramichi Fishing Cooperative are overfishing. Fishes are caught when they are on their way upstream to lay eggs. Consequently, not enough fish are left to reproduce in large numbers. The members of the cooperative say that they have already reduced their annual catch by 50%. However, my studies indicate that they took fewer fish because there were fewer fish to catch, not because they were trying to preserve fishes.
Questions 14 to 17 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 14.
What was the speaker assigned to do in the past year?
Question 15.
What is one of the problems in the Biramichi River?
Question 16.
What does the passage tell us about the factories along the river?
Question 17.
Why was the annual catch of fish in the Biramichi River reduced according to the speaker?
Part 3, Chapter 2, Exercise 1.
Passage 1. Men have travelled ever since they first appeared on the earth. In primitive times, they did not travel for pleasure, but to find new places where their herds could feed, or to escape from hostile neighbours, or to find more favourable climates. They travelled on foot. Their journeys were long, tiring, and often dangerous. They protected themselves with simple weapons, such as wooden sticks or stones, clubs, and by lighting fires at night, and, above all, by keeping together. Being intelligent and creative, they soon discovered easier ways of travelling. They rode on the back of their domesticated animals. They hollowed out tree trunks and, by using bits of wood as paddles, were able to travel across water. Later, they travelled not for necessity, but for the joy and excitement of seeing and experiencing new things. This is still the main reason why we travel today. Travelling, of course, has now become a highly organised business. There are cars and splendid roads, express trains, huge ships and jet airliners, all of which provide us with comforts and security. This sounds wonderful, but there are difficulties. If you want to go abroad, you need a passport and a visa, tickets, luggage, and 101 other things. If you lose any of them, your journey may be ruined.
Questions 1 to 3 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 1.
How were the primitive men's journeys?
Question 2.
What did people travel for later?
Question 3.
What modern means of transportation are mentioned in the passage?
Passage 2. In the 1970s, the famous Brazilian football player Pelé retired from the national team of Brazil and became a professional player for a team in New York. Football or soccer wasn't very popular in the United States at the time. Few North Americans knew anything about this fast-moving sport. There was no money to pay professional players, and there was little interest in football in high schools and colleges. When Pelé and other international stars began playing in various US cities, people saw how interesting the game was and began to go to the matches. It is now common for important games to have 50 to 60,000 fans. Support from the fans is important to the football. The fans cheer enthusiastically for their favourite players and teams, who respond by playing better than before. In most World Cups, the home team, or the team from the host country, usually plays better than most people expect. In 1966, 1974, and 1978, the home teams of England, West Germany, and Argentina all won the World Cup. The World Cup is called that because teams from every continent play in it. However, since the Cup began, all of the winning teams have been from Europe or South America. Teams from Asia or Africa always do well, but they haven't yet won. Mexico played surprisingly well in the 1970 Cup, which it hosted, but it wasn't among the four final teams.
Questions 4 to 6 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 4.
Why wasn't football a popular sport in the US in the 1970s?
Question 5.
When does a football team have the best chance to win the World Cup?
Question 6.
How did Mexico do in the 1970 World Cup?
Passage 3. In many countries, in the process of industrialization, overcrowded cities present a major problem. Poor conditions in these cities, such as lack of housing, inadequate public facilities, and lack of employment, bring about an increase in poverty, disease, and crime. The overpopulation of towns is mainly caused by the drift of large numbers of people from the rural areas. These people have become dissatisfied with the traditional life of farming and have come to the towns hoping for better work and pay. One possible solution to the problem would be to impose registration on town residents. Only officially registered residents would be allowed to live in the towns and the urban population would thus be limited. In practice, however, registration would be very difficult to enforce. It would cause a great deal of resentment, which would ultimately lead to violence. The only long-term solution is to make life in the rural areas more attractive, which would encourage people to stay there. This could be achieved by providing encouragement for people to go and work in the villages. Facilities in the rural areas, such as transport, health and education services, should be improved. Education should include training in improved methods of farming and other rural industries, so as to develop a more positive attitude towards rural life. The improvement of life in the villages is very important because the towns themselves cannot be developed without the simultaneous or previous development of the rural area.
Questions 7 to 9 are based on the passage that you have just heard. Question 7.
Why have a large number of farmers poured into towns?
Question 8.
According to the speaker, why would registrations on town residents be difficult to enforce?
Question 9.
In the speaker's opinion, what is the long-term solution to the problem with crowded cities?
Passage 4. Today, cigarette smoking is a widespread habit. About 43% of the adult men and 31% of the adult women in the United States smoke cigarettes regularly. It is encouraging to note, however, that millions of people have given up the smoking habit. 75% of the male population and 46% of the female population have smoked cigarettes at some time during their lives. But 26% of these men and 11% of women have stopped smoking. The number of persons who have given up smoking is increasing. Men as a group smoke more than women. Among both men and women, the age group which the highest proportion of smokers is the age group 24 to 44. Income, education and occupation all play a part in determining a person's smoking habits. City people smoke more than people living on farms. Well-educated men and high incomes are less likely to smoke cigarettes than men with fewer years of schooling and lower incomes. On the other hand, if a well-educated man with higher income smokes at all, he is likely to smoke more packs of cigarettes per day. The situation is somewhat different for women. There are slightly more smokers among women with higher family incomes and higher education than among the lower income and lower educational groups. These more highly educated women tend to smoke more heavily. Among teenagers, the picture is similar. There are fewer teenaged smokers from upper income, well-educated families, and fewer from families living in farm areas. High school students who are preparing for college are less likely to smoke than those who do not plan to continue their education after high school. Children are more likely to start smoking if one or both of their parents smoke.
Questions 10 to 13 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 10.
What determines a person's smoking habits?
Question 11.
Which of the following is true according to the passage?
Question 12.
What is the smoking situation for women?
Question 13.
What can we say about teenage smokers?
Passage 5. The space shuttle Discovery has safely returned to Earth after 2 weeks in Earth's orbit. Discovery Commander Eileen Collins guided the shuttle to an easy landing at Edwards Air Force Base in California early Tuesday. American Space Agency officials described Discovery's trip as wildly successful, but they refused to say when the shuttle may fly again. The space agency has suspended future shuttle flights until it can discover why a piece of hard protective material broke off from Discovery. A similar incident damaged the Columbia space shuttle in 2003. Columbia was destroyed as it re-entered the Earth's atmosphere. Japan has marked the 60th anniversary of the atomic bomb attack on the city of Nagasaki. The American bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima ended World War II. Nagasaki Mayor Eiichiro Oto called for a world ban on nuclear weapons. He urged Americans to ask if the United States needs thousands of nuclear arms to guarantee its security. A short time later, Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi said he would work to keep Japan free of nuclear weapons. In Cambodia, an opposition politician has been sentenced to 7 years in prison for plotting to overthrow the government. Chiam Chani was arrested in February after the National Assembly cancelled his parliamentary protection from legal charges. He denies any wrongdoing. A court found Chiam Chani and opposition member Kom Peseth guilty. Kom Peseth received a 5-year prison sentence.
Questions 14 to 16 are based on the passage you've just heard. Question 14.
How did American Space Agency officials describe Discovery's trip?
Question 15.
What did Nagasaki Mayor call for?
Question 16.
What was the charge against the two opposition politicians?
Passage 6. For 25 years, I was a full-time thief, specialising in picking pockets. Where I come from, southeast London, that is an honourable profession. Anyone can break into a house and steal things, but picking someone's pocket takes skill. My sister and I were among the most successful pickpocket team in London. We worked at hotels, theatre lobbies, airports, shopping centres and restaurants. Now we don't steal anymore, but the crime is worldwide. Here is how to protect yourself. Professional pickpockets do not see victims only handbags, jewellery and money. Mothers with babies, the elderly, the disabled are all fair game. My preferred target was lone female handbags at her side. The right side to be exact. So if I'm next to her, I can reach her cautiously with my right hand cross my body. Only about one woman in 1,000 carries her bag on the left, and I tended to steer clear of them. Women whose bags are hanging in front of them are tricky for the pickpocket, as there isn't a blind side. If you want to make it even harder, use a bag with handles rather than strap. For men, one of the best places to keep a wallet is in the back pocket of tight trousers. You will feel any attempts to move it. Another good place is in the buttoned-up inside pocket of a jacket. There is just no way in. Even better, keep wallets attached to a cord or chain that is fastened to a belt. A pickpocket needs targets who are relaxed and off guard. The perfect setting is a clothing store. When customers wander among the racks, they are completely absorbed in the items they hold up. The presence of a uniformed security guard is even better. A false sense of security makes a pickpocket's job much simpler.
Questions 17 to 20 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 17.
Why does the speaker say that picking somebody's pocket is an honourable profession in South East London?
Question 18.
According to the speaker, who is most likely to become the victim of the pickpockets?
Question 19.
In the speaker's opinion, what's the best place for a man to keep his wallet?
Question 20.
What is the perfect setting for picking pockets, according to the speaker?
Exercise 2.
Passage 1. Welcome to our aquarium. As we begin our tour, the first animal we will see today is the starfish. You probably have seen pictures of the starfish, but in a few minutes you will see some live ones and learn a little about their structure and life cycle. First of all, starfish are not really fish. They belong to the family of echinoderms, which are spiny, skinned sea animals. That is, their skin is covered with thorny bumps. Most starfish have five arms, like extensions on their bodies. And so they look like a five-pointed star. But some other kinds have as many as 40 or more arms. Starfish, like other members of the echinoderms family, have what's called radial symmetry. All that means is that their body parts of these animals are arranged around the centre, kind of like spokes of a wheel around a hub. One of the special features of the starfish is that it can drop off arms as a defensive reaction, to get away from an attacker, for example. They can then grow new arms to replace the old ones. starfish reproduce by releasing eggs into the seas. These eggs develop into larvae and can swim freely. These early forms, which are what larvae are, differ from adult starfish because the larvae have bilateral symmetry. That means that the two halves of the larvae look exactly the same, which makes them look a lot different from the latter forms of the starfish. Eventually, the larvae sink to the ocean bottom and change into the adult radial form. If you don't have any questions, we will go in now and see some of the creatures in person.
Questions 1 to 4 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 1.
What is the talk mainly about?
Question 2.
What does the speaker say about the skin of starfish?
Question 3.
Why does the speaker give the example of a hub of a wheel surrounded by spokes?
Question 4.
What is the major difference between newly developed and adult starfish?
Passage 2. Located at the NASA Research Center in Iowa, is a 5,000-gallon vat of water, and inside the tank is an underwater treadmill designed by Dave Newman, an aerospace engineer. For 4 years, Newman observed scuba divers as they simulated walking on the moon and on Mars on her underwater moving belt. She wanted to discover how the gravity of the moon and of Mars would affect human movement. To do this, Newman attached weights to the divers and then lowered them into the tank and onto the treadmill. These weights were carefully adjusted so that the divers could experience the underwater gravity of the moon and of Mars as they walked on the treadmill. Newman concluded that walking on Mars would probably be easier than walking on the moon. The moon has less gravity than Mars does, so a lunar gravity. The divers struggled to keep their balance and walked awkwardly. But at Martian gravity, the divers had greater traction and stability and could easily adjust to a pace of 1.5 miles per hour. As Newman gradually increased the speed of the treadmill, the divers took longer, graceful strides until they comfortably settled into an even quicker pace. Newman also noted that at Martian gravity, the divers needed less oxygen. The data Newman collected will help in the future design of Martian spacesuits. Compared to lunar spacesuits, Martian spacesuits will require smaller air tanks, and to allow for freer movement, the elbow and knee areas of the spacesuits will also be altered.
Questions 5 to 8 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 5.
What did Newman change so that the divers could experience different gravity levels?
Question 6.
Why will Martian spacesuits be designed differently from lunar spacesuits?
Question 7.
What happened to the divers at Martian gravity when the speed of the treadmill was increased?
Question 8.
What is one way that the design of Martian spacesuits will differ from lunar spacesuits?
Passage 3. Welcome to the Four Winds Historical Farm, where traditions of the past are preserved for visitors like you. Today our master thatchers will begin giving this barn behind me a solid thatched roof able to withstand heavy winds and last up to 100 years. How do they do it? Well, in a nutshell, thatching involves covering the beams or rafters, the wooden skeleton of the roof, with reeds or straw. Our thatchers here have harvested their own natural materials for the job. The bundles of water reeds you see lying over there beside the barn. Thatching is certainly uncommon in the United States today. I guess that's why so many of you have come to see this demonstration. But it wasn't always that way. In the 17th century, the colonists here thatched their roofs with reeds and straw just as they had done in England. After a while, though, they began to replace the thatch with wooden shingles because woods were so plentiful. And eventually other roofing materials like stone, slate and clay tiles became into use. It's a real shame that most people today don't realise how strong and long-lasting a thatched roof is. In Ireland, where thatching is still practised, the roof can survive winds of up to 110 miles per hour. That's because straw and reeds are so flexible. They bend, but don't break in the wind like other materials can. Another advantage is that the roofs keep the house cool in the summer and warm in the winter. And then, of course, there's the roof's longevity. The average is 60 years, but they can last up to 100. With all these reasons to start thatching roofs again, wouldn't it be wonderful to see this disappearing craft return to popularity?
Questions 9 to 12 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 9.
What is about to be demonstrated?
Question 10.
According to the speaker, why did thatching die out in the United States?
Question 11.
According to the speaker, why does thatch survive strong winds?
Question 12.
According to the speaker, how might thatching become popular again?
Passage 4. As you probably know, log structures are gaining popularity. They are no longer just the simple country homes that we think of as the traditional log cabin. Some upscale homes now incorporate natural round logs in ceiling beams and walls, People seem to think that the rounded logs give their homes a cozy, warm atmosphere. And even people who want to build a traditional log cabin on their own can buy kits with pre-cut logs that fit together like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. Before showing you some slides of modern log houses, I'd like to give you a little historical background on the subject. Log cabins were first built in the late 1600s along the Delaware River Valley. The European immigrants who settled there brought centuries-old traditions of working with logs. And in this heavily wooded area, logs were the material at hand. Log cabins were most popular in the early 1800s with the settlers who were moving west. They provided the answer to the pioneers' need for a safe and sturdy home that an ordinary family could build quickly. They had dirt floors and sliding boards for windows. But the log buildings that have probably had the most influence on modern architects are those of the mountain retreats of wealthy New Yorkers. These country houses, which were popular in the early 1900s, typify what is known as the Adirondack style. Now, let's look at those slides.
Questions 13 to 16 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 13.
What is the speaker mainly discussing?
Question 14.
According to the speaker, what do many people think gives modern homes a warm atmosphere?
Question 15.
Why did the early settlers use logs for building homes?
Question 16.
According to the speaker, why were log cabins especially popular with settlers who moved west?
Passage 5. The ups and downs of life may seem to have no predictable plan, but scientists now know there are very definite patterns that almost all people share. Even if you've passed some of your prime, you still have seem to peak later in life. When are you smartest? From 18 to 25, according to IQ scores, but you're wiser and more experienced with increasing age. You're sharpest in your 20s. Around 30, memory begins to decline, particularly your ability to perform mathematical computations. But your IQ for other tasks climb. Your vocabulary at age 45, for example, is 3 times as great as when you graduate from college. At 60, your brain possesses almost 4 times as much information as it did at 21. This trade-off between sharpness and wisdom has led psychologists to suggest that maturity quotients, or MQ, be adopted for adults. When are you happiest? You have the best physical sense of yourself from 15 to 24. The best professional sense from 40 to 49. Before age 24, we believe that our happiest years are yet to come. Over 30, we believe that they're behind us. A National Health Survey agrees. After age 30, we become more realistic and do not view happiness as a goal in itself. If we maintain our health, achieve professional and emotional goals, and then happiness, we feel, will follow.
Questions 17 to 20 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 17.
According to the passage, what do we know about our life patterns?
Question 18.
Why do scientists suggest that maturity quotients be adopted for adults?
Question 19.
According to the speaker, when are people happiest?
Question 20.
What is the passage talking about? Exercise 3.
Passage 1. When we talk about intelligence, we do not mean the ability to get good scores on certain kinds of tests, or even the ability to do well in school. By intelligence, we mean a way of living and behaving, especially in a new or upsetting situation. If we want to test intelligence, we need to find out how a person acts instead of how much he knows what to do. For instance, when in a new situation, an intelligent person thinks about the situation, not about himself or what might happen to him. He tries to find out all he can, and then he acts at once and tries to do something about it. He probably isn't sure how it will work out, but at least he tries. And if he can't make things work out right, he doesn't feel ashamed that he failed. He just tries to learn from his mistakes. An intelligent person, even if he is very young, has a special outlook on life, a special feeling about life, and how he fits into it. If you look at children, you'll see great difference between what we call bright children and non-bright children. They are actually two different kinds of people, not just the same kind with different amount of intelligence. For example, the bright child really wants to find out about life. He tries to get in touch with everything around him. But the unintelligent child keeps more to himself and his own dream world. He seems to have a wall between him and life in general.
Questions 1 to 3 are based on the passage you've just heard. Question 1.
What is intelligence according to the speaker?
Question 2.
Who in the following is intelligent according to the passage?
Question 3.
What does a non-bright child tend to be?
Passage 2. There's an art exhibition here on campus which ties in well with the discussion we had about folk art. It's an exhibition on wildlife art calendars from about 100 years ago. Like most other folk art, the calendar pictures were not considered to be art in their own day. People just thought of them as a way of decorating a practical object. In fact, the calendar pictures were originally printed as advertising for various companies that made hunting or fishing products, like guns or fishing rods. The calendars were handed out free to customers to thank them for their business. Most people just hung the calendars on their walls where the pictures faded in the sun, and then tore the pictures off the calendar as each month passed. As a result, collectors today place a lot of value on calendars that are complete and in good condition. Even though the people who used the calendars didn't regard them as art, the original paintings the prints were made from were often of good quality. In fact, many famous wildlife painters created calendar art at some point in their lives. To them, it was a way of getting their work reproduced and shown around. One aspect of the exhibit that I find very interesting is the way these pictures reflect changing attitudes towards wildlife. The pictures in the exhibit often portray the thrill and adventure of hunting, rather than any particular concern for wildlife preservation. But most of today's wildlife art shows animals in their natural surroundings, without any humans in the scene. This modern wildlife art appeals to large numbers of nature lovers, even those who oppose the practice of hunting.
Questions 4 to 7 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 4.
What is the talk mainly about?
Question 5.
According to the speaker, why is it difficult to find calendar pictures that are in good condition?
Question 6.
According to the speaker, why did artists want to produce work for calendars?
Question 7.
What was the theme for many early wildlife calendars?
Passage 3. The games of a culture can help us understand a great deal about their history, religion, and belief system. The Indians, specifically, revealed a great deal about themselves by playing games. Almost all Indians, regardless of their age, gender, or physical condition, played games. Women played games as much as men, but they usually played separately from the men and had different games. Children also played games. As a matter of fact, they often played the same games that their parents enjoyed. Most of the games had a religious meaning attached to them. Many of the tribes used the games to train warriors and to win honors. As the years wore on, however, that meaning was lost, but the game continued to be played. Many Indians enjoyed shooting arrows as a sport. They used many varieties of targets, including pieces of bark, women grass, or an arrow stuck in a tree. Quieter amusements included games of chance. For example, pieces of cloth would be used to cover various items determined by one person. The other person would randomly choose one of the hidden items. His or her choice would reveal their past as well as their future. Other popular games were guessing games. One guessing game, for instance, would require a group to guess the number of rocks in a certain area. Then they would count the actual number and rank the people who guessed according to how close they came to the actual number.
Questions 8 to 10 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 8.
What can be said about Indian women?
Question 9.
What does the speaker say about most Indian games?
Question 10.
What sport did many Indians doing as a sport?
Passage 4. Most of us grow up taking certain things for granted. We tend to assume that experts and religious leaders tell us the truth. We tend to believe that things advertised on television or in newspapers can't be bad for us. However, encouragement of critical thinking in students is one of the goals of most colleges and universities. Few professors require students to share the professor's own beliefs. In general, professors are more concerned that students learn to question and critically examine the arguments of others, including some of their own beliefs or values. This does not mean that professors insist that you change your beliefs either. It does mean, however, professors will usually ask you to support the views you express in class or in your writing. If your premises are shaky or if your arguments are not logical, professors personally point out the false reasoning in your argument. Most professors want you to recognize the premises of your argument, to examine whether you really accept these premises and to understand whether or not you draw logical conclusions. Put it this way, professors don't tell you what to think, they try to teach you how to think. On the other hand, if you intend to disagree with your professor in class, you should be prepared to offer a strong argument in support of your ideas. Arguing just for the sake of arguing usually does not promote a critical examination of ideas. Many professors interpret it as rudeness.
Questions 11 to 14 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 11.
According to the speaker, what do most people tend to believe during their growth?
Question 12.
Nowadays, what do most colleges and universities encourage students to do?
Question 13.
What do professors mainly teach them to help students develop their critical thinking?
Question 14.
In the speaker's opinion, what is the right way to argue?
Passage 5. You may remember that a few weeks ago we discussed the question of what photography is. Is it art or is it a method of reproducing images? Does photography belong in museums or just in our homes? Today I want to talk about a person who tried to make his professional life an answer to such questions. Alfred Stieglitz went from the United States to Germany to study engineering. While he was over there, he became interested in photography and began to experiment with his camera. He took pictures under conditions that most photographers considered too difficult. He took them at night, in the rain, and of people and objects reflected in windows. When he returned to the United States, he continued his revolutionary effort. Stieglitz was the first person to photograph skyscrapers, clouds, and views from an airplane. What Stieglitz was trying to do in his photographs was what he tried to do throughout his life: make photography an art. He thought that photography could be just as beautiful a form of self-expression as painting or drawing. For Stieglitz, his camera was his brush. While many photographers in the late 1800s and early 1900s thought of their work as a reproduction of identical images, Stieglitz saw his as a creative art form. He understood the power of the camera to capture the moment. In fact, he never retouched his prints or made copies of them. If you are in this class today, I'm sure you'd say, "Well, painters don't normally make extra copies of their paintings, do they?"
Question 15 to 18 are based on the passage you've just heard. Question 15.
What is the professor mainly discussing?
Question 16.
What question has the professor raised in the previous class?
Question 17.
What does the professor imply about the photographs Stieglitz took at night?
Question 18.
Why did Stieglitz choose not to make copies of his photographs?
Exercise 4.
Passage 1. Many a young person tells me he wants to be a writer. I always encourage such people, but I also explain that there's a big difference between being a writer and writing. In most cases, they are dreaming of wealth and fame, not the long hours alone at a typewriter. "You've got to want to write," I say to them, "not want to be a writer." The reality is that writing is a lonely, private, and poor-paying affair. For every writer kissed by fortune, there are thousands more whose work is never rewarded. When I left a 20-year career in US Coast Guard to become a freelance writer, I had no prospects at all. What I did have was a friend who found my room in a New York apartment building. It didn't even matter that it was cold and had no bathroom. I immediately bought a used typewriter and felt like a good writer. After a year, I still hadn't got a break and began to doubt myself. It was so hard to sell a story that I barely made enough to eat. But I knew I wanted to write. I had dreamed about it for years. I wasn't going to be one of those people who die wondering what I would keep putting my dream to the test. even though it meant living with uncertainty and fear of failure. This is the shadow land of hope. Anyone with a dream must learn to live there.
Questions 1 to 3 are based on the passage you've just heard. Question 1.
What does this passage want to tell us?
Question 2.
Why did the author begin to doubt himself after the first year of his writing career?
Question 3.
What is the shadow land of hope in the writer's point of view?
Passage 2. The first person to reach the South Pole was Ronald Amundsen, a Norwegian explorer. Amundsen was born in Borge, near Oslo, Norway. He attended the University of Christiania and then joined the Norwegian Navy. Amundsen made a 3-year expedition in the Arctic beginning in 1903. He was the first to navigate the Northwest Passage, a northern water route from the Atlantic to the Pacific. But Amundsen's greatest voyage began in 1910, at the other end of the Earth. He intended to go to the North Pole, but he heard that Robert Peary had already reached it. So instead, Amundsen headed to the South Pole in his ship, Fram. He learned that a British expedition, led by Robert F. Scott, was also on its way there. Amundsen reached Antarctica in January 1911. He and his men had to wait out the bitter cold, windy winter on the edge of the ice before they could head for the South Pole. In October, Antarctica's spring, they set out, with 52 well-trained dogs to pull their sledges. On the way to the South Pole, they climbed glaciers, went around huge cracks in the ice, and survived freezing blizzards. Finally, on December 14th, 1911, Amundsen placed the Norwegian flag at the South Pole. Scott and his men found the flag there when they reached the pole, a month after Amundsen's party. Amundsen died in the Arctic 17 years later. He disappeared while making an air search for another explorer, Umber, to Nobile.
Questions 4 to 7 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 4.
Which is the best title for the passage?
Question 5.
Why did it take them a whole year from Antarctic to reach the South Pole?
Question 6.
Why did Amundsen change his idea to go to the North Pole instead of the South Pole?
Question 7.
What can be inferred from this passage?
Passage 3. Before we enter Exhibit 1, I want to talk a little bit about the personal history of architect Frank Lloyd Wright. We'll be viewing many of his designs this afternoon. Wright was born in 1869 in rural Wisconsin and developed an interest in architecture as a young boy. Though he studied for years under Louis Sullivan, a leader at that time at the Chicago School of Architecture, Wright rejected much of the prominent architectural trends of his day. He instead devoted his efforts to the development of his own natural style of design, in which buildings reflected their natural surroundings. When he decided to build a winter home for himself in 1938, Wright chose an isolated stretch of desert located in Arizona, over the more metropolitans he had frequently worked in, and to which he had contributed several notable skyscrapers. The interior of his home was filled with furnishings that reflected the principles Wright employed in his exterior creations. His desire to design all facets of a home, including rugs, windows, and walls as furniture, that demonstrated a strong belief that a home should be a total environment for its inhabitants. Wright's unwavering dedication to this ideal helped to popularize his particular style of design, called organic architecture. In an attempt to create a supportive environment for students of this style of architecture, Wright founded a community of architects near Talazion West, his Arizona home. This community still thrives today, and works we are about to see have a profound influence on much of the current output of its architects.
Questions 8 to 11 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 8.
What is the primary purpose of the talk?
Question 9.
What was a significant influence on Wright's architecture?
Question 10.
What would be most likely to represent one of Wright's designs?
Question 11.
According to the speaker, how did Wright try to promote his style of architecture?
Passage 4. Continuing our survey of the 19th century, let's take a look now at Harriet Beecher Stowe. Now, Stowe is best known for her novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, a book that details the harshness of plantation life in the South. The book was extremely popular in the United States as well as in other countries. Ironically, though, despite the attention given to Uncle Tom's Cabin, it is far from Stowe's best work. She did write one other novel about life in the South, but much of her best work has nothing to do with life in the South at all. In fact, Stowe's best writing is about village life in New England states in the 19th century. In recording the customs of the villages she wrote about, Stowe claimed that her purpose was to reflect the images as realistically as possible. She usually succeeded, for her settings were often described realistically and in detail. In this sense, she was an important forerunner of the realistic movement that became popular later in the 19th century. She was one of the first writers to use local dialect for the characters when they spoke. And she did this 30 years before Mark Twain popularized the use of local dialects. It makes sense that Stowe would write about New England life, since she was born in Connecticut. As a young woman there, she worked as a teacher. The teaching job helped lead her first published work, a geography book for children. Later, when she was married, her writing helped to support her family financially. Throughout her life, she wrote poems, travel books, biographical sketches, and children's books, as well as novels for adults.
Questions 12 to 15 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 12.
What is the main purpose of the talk?
Question 13.
What does the speaker say about the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin?
Question 14.
Why does the speaker mention Mark Twain?
Question 15.
What was Stowe's first published work?
Passage 5. Many university students dislike studying history because there is little to get excited about when historical events are presented in a boring manner. However, I'll never forget my American history professor, Dr. Williamson. Each event leaped from the pages of our text and became as real as the daily news report on the radio. My favorite lecture concerned the American Revolution. Dr. Williamson set the mood for the story by imitating Paul Revere, a well-known silversmith working in his shop. The American colonies were angry because of the British control over their lives. Revere felt that the war between the British and the colonists was going to happen immediately. Then, Dr. Williamson told us about Revere rowing across the Charles River from Boston on April the 18th, 1775. I can see the professor now as he raised his hand to his forehead, as if he were looking across the Charles River to the Old North Church in Boston. Suddenly, Revere spotted two lanterns, a signal which meant that the British would attack by sea. He jumped on his horse to warn the villagers of the attack. Professor Williamson reminded us that the first battles of the American Revolution were fought at Concord and at Lexington, Massachusetts, the year before the Declaration of Independence was signed in 1776. Never before had history seemed so alive to me, all because a professor cared enough to put his heart into his teaching.
Questions 16 to 18 are based on the passage you've just heard. Question 16.
According to the speaker, why do most students dislike history?
Question 17.
Where was the Old North Church located?
Question 18.
What did the two lantern signal tell Revere? ¶¶